Welcome to our second live Q&A session of the day. Dr. Turin Yock will moderate the questions that came in for the pediatric, flash radiation therapy, and head and neck sessions.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be with you all virtually. Thank you so much for joining us. And as you've heard over the course of the day, you've been with Dr. Billy Liu from Stanford, who talked about flash radiotherapy, and Dr. Kenneth Hugh from NYU, who just finished giving us a talk on head and neck. And so we've got a few questions that have come in, and there seem to be more in the head and neck arena. So I think we should start with the first one for Dr. Hugh. So the question that's rising to the top is, have you de-escalated therapy for HPV-positive oropharyngeal cancer?
Sure. Everyone is interested in doing de-escalation. And definitely here at NYU, we have a protocol where we de-escalate patients based on their mid-treatment response. So if they have early shrinkage of their tumor, we de-escalate the dose from 70 to 60 gray, which is the dose that's got the most experience, although I would say I would not de-escalate a patient off trial. All of this remains experimental.
All right, thank you very much. I think we have another, let's move to Dr. Liu. The question that rises to the top is, what is thought to be the reason why tumor cells are not also spared as the normal tissues are because of the potential anoxic effects of flash radiotherapy?
Yeah, that's a great question. One might imagine that if this radiochemical oxygen depletion effect is an important underlying mechanism, that tumors that have underlying hypoxia may also be spared. And in fact, you know, that has been seen in the in vitro setting where you're looking at tumor cells grown in culture. Some of those early experiments showing the oxygen depletion effect were in tumor cell lines. In vivo, however, so far, we have not seen tumor sparing by flash, and that raises the question of why. Doug Spitz from University of Iowa has suggested that because of iron chemistry, the way that tumor cells process free radical damage based on iron chemistry versus normal cells, that the tumor cells may not be able to handle the higher load of free radicals, and therefore that may offset the protection from the oxygen depletion. Another thing that we've seen, and I mentioned in the presentation, as well as the Cincinnati Children's Hospital group has seen with flash, the enhancement of immune cell infiltration in at least a couple of tumor models. And so it may be an interaction related to a differential immune response. What causes that is also unknown at this point. So there's a lot to explore, but it remains a very intriguing observation.
Great, thank you. We have a lot of questions in the head and neck region, so I think I'd like to go back to Dr. Hugh. So how do you manage long-term xerostomia?
Prevention is the best course of action when we deal with xerostomia, right? So just because we have the group together and everyone's focused on toxicities, it's not just the parotid gland, right, that we're concerned about when it comes to xerostomia. It's the submandibular gland, it's the minor salivary glands of the oral cavity. So when you're doing your planning, you should try to minimize those and outline them as an OAR. But when you do have xerostomia, what I look at is the time course from treatment. Because when you look at the recovery of the salivary glands, it can occur up to 2 years after the radiation is done when you're giving IMRT radiation. All this great work from Avi Eisbrook at University of Michigan shows that you can get salivary recovery. But in terms of managing acute problems, we usually give them salivary secretagogues, something that's going to stimulate salivary flow, like sugarless sour drops. There's a coating agent, a sorbitol time-release coating agent called Xylomelt that people can use when they're sleeping. They can just put this tablet underneath their lip and it helps coat their mouths for several hours. For longer term issues, there is some evidence that acupuncture can improve salivary flow. There are medications such as Evosac that have been utilized, but most of these interventions are not a home run. They kind of give you some benefit, and not all patients do benefit from that. When I see a patient with xerostomia, I'm very concerned about the health of their teeth. So I'm always making sure that they're taking good preventive care using prescription fluoride, as well as rinsing their mouths with oral antiseptic to make sure they don't get into problems with dental caries.
All right, very good, thank you. So we have two pediatric questions, so I'll address the first one. The first question is, can you comment on hypofractionation in pontine gliomas? And that's a fantastic question. There's a few people around the world who've been using hypofractionation, and there's been a recent review article that looks at whether we can get away with it. And clearly we can get away with it, but in the meta-analysis, the overall survival was higher in the standard fractionation arm than it was in the hypofractionation arm. It was not statistically significant. And in the randomized trial that was also done, which was also very small numbers, the trend was in favor of standard fractionation versus hypofractionation. But so you can't say anything conclusively. And I suspect that some of these retrospective looks at the kids that have had hypofractionation, there's a reason why they got hypofractionation. So I'm not sure that without a larger scale randomized trial, we can definitively say one thing or another. But in this study, which is in Advances of Radiation Oncology, and the first author is Galito, G-A-L-L-I-T-T-O, published in 2019, the median overall survival for the kids that had standard fractionation was 12 months, and the median overall survival in the kids that had hypofractionation was 8 months. And so although there wasn't a statistically significant difference, when you look at the whisker plots, they do look a little bit different. So it's worth reading and sort of deciding for yourself what the best approach is for a given situation for a patient. Thanks. So let's move on to another question for Dr. Liu. Does the quality of radiation therapy or does the modality of radiation therapy make a difference in late effects with flash radiation? For example, protons versus electrons versus photons, et cetera.
Right, also a great question. To date, none of these has been compared directly head to head in any of these preclinical studies. But what we can say is that there have been experiments comparing flash to conventional dose rate using electrons, using protons, and also using X-rays from a synchrotron light source, all of which have demonstrated, flash effects. So regardless of the particle type, it's unclear whether the effects are going to be the same dose for dose between all the different types of radiation. If I had to guess, I would say probably it should be the same, but all of these effects are so unexpected in the first place, it's hard to extrapolate from classical knowledge, but it has been observed across multiple different beam types.
Great, thank you so much. So another question for Dr. Hugh. For post-op patients with a tracheostomy, should we boost the stoma or tracheostomy? If yes, how far into the trachea and what dose?
The tracheostomy boost issue is something that relates to how it was placed. If it was placed in an emergent fashion where there could be a seeding of the tissue, then you definitely would need to do a boost. If there's disease that's close by in the surgical setting, pathologically, you'd have to ask, you know, your surgeon and review the imaging to determine that. You would consider doing a boost treatment. And what I would do is, boy, this really goes back a long time ago, because I normally we would have boosted with electrons, but in the setting of IMRT, I normally just include them at least to an intermediate dose of radiation or post-op dose of radiation, and I adjust the dose based on the risk of actually seeding. So for a patient with, you know, close or positive margin or emergent trach, I probably would boost it to a dose of 60 gray. But if the patient is, not emergently trached or has no risk factors, I still, just because it's so close to the supraclav nodal area that you're addressing, I still treat that area. So in general, in the setting of, in the era of IMRT, I always treat the tracheostomy site, but just vary the dose depending on the level of risk I think it's at.
Very good, thank you. So let's maybe give Dr. Liu another question. Why use the plateau portion for flash as opposed to the flash delivery in the Bragg peak?
Right, so this pertains to the proton studies using the proton beam for flash in mice. And I think there were some technical reasons for that. One is that it had to do with the reliability of the dosimetry. So to really understand the dose and that it's being delivered uniformly throughout the entire volume being irradiated, the plateau portion was used. In addition, trying to adjust the range based on the depth of the Bragg peak, you know, putting in physical range modulators actually in some settings really attenuated the dose rates that could be achieved. So for a number of technical reasons, those preclinical experiments were, at least in the UPenn study, was done with the plateau portion. There have been other studies not reporting biological results, but mainly kind of the technical aspects using things like ridge filters and so on to use the Bragg peak portion. But I am not aware of kind of clear biological results from that approach yet.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And then Dr. Hugh, I think you've got the most questions, so I'm going to keep coming back to you. The next one is there a role for serum squamous cell carcinoma antigen in diagnosis and follow-up of head and neck cancers?
Definitely. There's a lot of interest in these virally related cancers. We talked about Epstein-Barr virus for nasopharynx cancer, as well as HPV for oropharynx cancer. So there's some evidence for nasopharynx. We talked about the NRG-001 trial where we're using plasma EBV titers to determine how to guide adjuvant treatment. In human papillomavirus, there's also a similar interest where there's early studies. Bisham Chera over at UNC has shown this at the last, I don't know if you were at the last head and neck meeting, where if you saw the plasma HPV levels typically directed against the E6 and E7 proteins that are very prominent in the HPV-infected tumor cells, you see that if there's no detectable HPV in the plasma after treatment, the control rates are 100%. So, and these are for his de-escalated patients. So I think it's one of these biomarkers that are going to be incorporated in future de-escalation trials. But great question, very, very exciting. Still not in in practice yet, and also availability of these tests, either for Epstein-Barr virus or for HPV, is not commercially available. Commercial labs may say they have these tests, but for EBV in particular, there's been a lot of difficulty getting very high accuracy of these tests, so that you need, so you can get some false negatives for sure. And so we actually did a trial looking at, with Billy Liu's group at Stanford, where Quinn Lee has done a lot of work with plasma EBV. And what we did was we took samples of plasma samples, and we sent them to commercial labs in some of our nasopharynx cancer positive patients. And then we sent the second half to a lab at Stanford or in Hong Kong. And we found that the accuracy of the commercial labs were sort of a coin toss, where we used the Stanford and the Hong Kong labs as the standard. So I wouldn't rely on commercial available testing for plasma EBV or HPV at this time. It still has to be worked out, and the detection methods harmonized.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So this one, I'm just going to give a follow-on question, just because there's so many stacking up in the head and neck region, head and neck section. When doing IMRT for early glottic cancer with anterior commissure involvement, would you bolus daily or every other day?
So I would say it depends. You may not even need to do bolus at all. If you look at the pre laryngeal tissue, so some people are very muscular or have a lot of fat in that area, you really don't need to bolus at all. If you're trying to target the anterior commissure, if someone's very thin, what we've done, instead of using a every other day bolus approach, that could be very that could be ripe for mistakes. And using a 5 millimeter bolus is what we've been trained to do. We tend to take a daily 3 millimeter bolus approach if you need to bolus the anterior neck to address the dose to the commissure. So if you do need to, that's what we do, is a 3 millimeter bolus every day.
Okay, great, thank you. So I want to maybe circle back to pediatrics, because it looks like I have two Ewing's questions that I can maybe address both at the same time. So the first one is, in Ewing's patients who present with the need for radiotherapy, for such as cord compression, would you start with concomitant chemoradiotherapy with the full curative dose? And so in general, what's happened in the past is that they present with cord compression, and then the surgeon goes in for decompressive laminectomy, taking out the tumor that's pressing on the spinal cord, gets the definitive diagnosis, but also releases the cord. So this hasn't specifically happened in any of the patients I've treated. That being said, if this patient has widely metastatic disease, your neurosurgeon's unavailable, or whatever the case may be, you can also start as soon as you can with chemotherapy, and then you do start with radiotherapy. But then this would be a case where if you start with a VAC, you would want to drop out the adriamycin. And sometimes you could also start with ifosfamide, etoposide as well. So I think there's a few ways to do this, but usually, it's the surgeon makes the diagnosis and gets the patient out of the risk zone. But there's a follow-up question on Ewing's. If you have a positive margin, at the time of surgery, what is the optimal time for radiotherapy after surgery? And that is a great question, and I'm not sure I can give you a definitive answer. But usually, it's after the patient's had sufficient time for healing. It's often in the pelvis that they have this large tumor that's taken out, and then whoops, there's a positive margin, we need to go and treat. And it's usually a couple cycles are given, and then we've treated in our experience. But I can't remember what's listed in the protocols as the optimal timing, but from the standpoint of the major disease has been taken out, and usually there's a healing concern, We usually sequence some chemotherapy in before starting the radiotherapy. I am at a proton center, so I do get patients from all over, and it's possible that we also use the chemotherapy as a bridge while we arrange for them to come for protons, because that probably wasn't initially thought about when they had the surgery. So sorry, I don't have a definitive answer for you, but I think it's not quite as important. The week 12 is generally when you come in with definitive radiotherapy, and that's usually when you come in with your definitive surgery as well. So let's circle back to actually Dr. Liu. So as the QA chair for my department, I actually really like this question. How would quality assurance testing be done for flash radiotherapy to measure the dose at depth? And would special equipment be needed?
Yeah, well, so I guess those questions are ones that we're currently applying to the preclinical research in terms of very accurate calibration of dose and characterizing the depth dose and transverse profiles and all of that. Because it turns out in preclinical research, that's not nailed down to the degree of rigor as it is in the clinic. And so even just establishing that from one lab to another, one gray equals one gray, you know, it turns out to be a pretty challenging problem. So that's something that we definitely pay attention to a lot in the preclinical setting. And then it's going to need to translate into the clinical setting if we actually enable clinical use of flash radiotherapy. So I think it will require new processes and workflows and potentially some new equipment. For example, monitor chambers are typically going to be saturated at the dose rates that we're talking about for flash. And so sort of backup strategies would be needed for that. And developing new detectors that are flash compatible is also another area of research that's been emerging in the medical physics and standards labs.
Wonderful, thank you. It certainly is an interesting topic. Moving on to Dr. Hugh, how would you manage a very large unresectable papillary thyroid cancer? What is the role for concurrent chemotherapy such as Taxol?
That's a great question. and I know probably some of your surgical colleagues are looking for help. For unresectable papillary thyroid cancers, there has been some evidence that you can control a decent number of patients with definitive radiation without surgery. And the best experience I would point to is a paper that Nancy Lee's group wrote over at Sloan Kettering, where they've given adriamycin concurrent with the IMRT based radiation to doses of 70 gray. You can certainly consider another radiosensitizer such as taxane. However, it's going to be pretty toxic whether you use the adria or the taxane. The adriamycin is given at a very low dose, a radiosensitizing dose of typically 20 to 30 milligrams per meter squared, during the radiation. With the taxane, I personally have to admit, I don't have much experience with that. I've always used adriamycin, but I certainly think that a taxane is very reasonable in that setting.
All right, very good. I think let's have a follow-up question. What is the preferred treatment now for locally advanced nasopharyngeal carcinoma with chemotherapy in light of the new data with gemcitabine and cisplatin?
Very good question. A lot of people from that New England Journal article are very excited about considering inductive chemotherapy versus our standard ALSA-RAF regimen of concurrent chemoradiation and adjuvant chemotherapy. So, I still think it's in flux. And I think either approach is very reasonable, since the New England Journal article, the experimental arm of giving induction chemotherapy followed by concurrent chemo radiation was just compared to concurrent chemo radiation alone without adjuvant therapy, which is what many people would consider the standard of care. So I would say one of the benefits of induction chemotherapy that the group from China showed was that you could potentially decrease toxicity by giving a definitive dose to the post-chemotherapy volume. So in my practice, how I've incorporated this is that for patients who have very advanced disease, either very bulky nodal disease, you know, N2 or N3 disease, or patients with very advanced T4 cancers where, you know, giving upfront chemo radiation is going to be tough in terms of long-term side effects, then I would consider doing the induction approach. And we use the regimen of this GEM-CIS regimen, since they're the best experience so far with the induction has been this experience. When you look at some of the meta-analysis, it's not quite clear that induction chemotherapy with other regimens is as good in terms of providing a survival benefit. So I would use that recently reported trial to treat patients with very advanced disease. For other patients who can tolerate standard treatment of concurrent upfront followed by adjuvant, I go with the standard of care that we've been practicing for 30 years.
Okay, so there's a somewhat related question in terms of that gets a lot of interest. What patient group would you use induction chemotherapy for in the head and neck arena?
In general?
Yeah, in general.
So that's very, especially with the all these trials from Dana-Farber, Torin, you might be familiar with that, the PARADIGM trial, as well as the DECIDE trial from University of Chicago that shows no benefit of induction chemotherapy for any subset of patients who have very, who are at high risk for distant metastasis, N2 or N3 disease. I tend not to use induction chemotherapy in general, only very selectively. So for patients with very advanced hypopharynx cancers or larynx cancers, where they're not doing well functionally, but they want to, so they don't, they're not breathing well, they're not swallowing well. If you give concurrent chemo radiation up front and there's no nothing to preserve, it's not worth, to me in my mind, considering an upfront chemotherapy approach and maybe send them to surgery. But if patients have some sort of baseline dysfunction and they do well after a cycle or two of induction chemotherapy, I use that to sort out which patients would go to organ preservation treatment and what patients should go to surgery. Because what the purpose of chemo radiation is not only to control local regional disease, but also to preserve organ function. For patients with very, very advanced disease, patients who I don't think are going to do well with concurrent chemo radiation, I would consider induction chemotherapy in a very selected subset of patients, just to, you know, for an unresectable patients where I know it's not going to, concurrent chemo radiation or whatever you do, the outcomes are not going to be great with standard of care. I would consider, if patients can tolerate induction chemotherapy, I've had patients with advanced oral tongue cancers, young patients who don't want to have upfront resection, even though they are resectable, they get induction chemotherapy. If they have a wonderful response, then I would consider organ preservation treatment, typically with concurrent chemo radiation and a brachytherapy boost. But use the induction to select which patients can regain their function and have something to preserve.
Okay, thank you very much. There's actually another somewhat related question, or two really that are related. This, it concerns patients that are clinical stage T4A, N2C, supraglottic laryngeal cancer. So I'll read the first one and then I'll follow up depending on your response. But it says, for the unresectable clinical T4A N2C supraglottic laryngeal cancer, would you ultimately consider resection after robust clinical response following upfront chemoradiotherapy? Actually, that's essentially the same question as ones lower down. If they had a CR, would you still refer for surgery?
Sure. In that situation, I probably would not. You know, would follow the patient very closely. And if, if they have, because there are patients where you're going to be able to salvage them or cure them with chemoradiation. It's just that the best, when you see patients up front with such disease, to offer the best chance of cure, it's going to be with resection followed by probably postoperative chemoradiation. But if patients elect to go this route of non-surgical treatment, then, and they have a wonderful response, then it wouldn't make sense to go ahead and proceed with resection, only for salvage.
All right, very good. Thank you. I'll let you get off the hot seat for a little bit, and I'll answer one of the pediatric questions, which is, what is the attitude of neurosurgeons to the risk of biopsy in difficult regions like the pineal gland or the pineal region? And this is a tough one because, quite frankly, different surgeons have different skill sets and different comforts in certain areas of the body. And some of them are comfortable in the pineal region where there's a venous plexus that makes it really difficult to sometimes resect, and others are not. And so I think you have to pay attention to what your neurosurgeon is telling you, because you don't want to push them to do something that they're not comfortable doing. That being said, I find it super helpful to have a biopsy, especially in the germ cell tumor patients, so we know specifically what we're dealing with. But unfortunately, we as radiation oncologists don't get to make that decision. I get to work with very good neurosurgeons and good neurosurgeons across town at Children's Hospital of Boston too. But I do know, and we see patients from all over that have different abilities. And so I think, it's really surgeon specific. So Dr. Liu, there's another question for you. Are conformal techniques such as the phaser device really necessary if the organs at risk are so well protected by the biologic advantage?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, if flash, is truly so magical that it causes no normal tissue damage, then, maybe we don't need conformal therapy anymore. Having said that, it's really not magic. From what we've seen, it shifts the dose response curve for normal tissue toxicity. So it's not that there's no toxicity, it's that the tolerance of the tissues to a given dose appears to be higher. And so it can increase the therapeutic index, but I would anticipate that the therapeutic index that you get from conformal therapy will remain important. And so really what we would want to do to get the maximum therapeutic index is to combine the two, to have conformal flash radiation. So that's kind of an extrapolation from just longstanding principles.
Can I ask one question of you, Billy, relevant to that point? Because I was at the multidisciplinary meeting just in Arizona. I was with Jean Borges, who's very interested in flash therapy, and he brought up that whole point about conformal therapy, that it's going to be very difficult to do conformal therapy with flash therapy. Do you see a solution for that to enable conformal therapy with all this work that's been done? Everyone's focused. You have a moving MLC, but that's so irrelevant, right, with flash therapy.
Right. So that's what we're trying to address with this technology development effort that we're doing with the phaser project. And, in addition to the linear accelerator technology to just produce a lot more beam, hundreds of times more beam to get the speed, we're trying to eliminate all the slow moving parts of the systems. That would include gantry motion, that would include MLC motion. So we've developed a number of different strategies. One is to have an array of linear accelerator beam lines to provide 16 simultaneous beam directions so that you don't have to rotate the gantry. The one key factor to making that possible is that the advances in the linear accelerator technology not only increase the performance, but also make it much more economical to manufacture. It's actually possible. We anticipate to have, you know, the 16 beam lines cost, you know, similar to what kind of an existing gantry-based system would cost. We've also devised an approach where by combining an extended Bremsstrahlung target and a multi-channel collimator, we can scan the electron beam on the Bremsstrahlung target and match it to this collimator array to essentially convert a scanning electron beam to a scanning photon pencil beam. So it's all electronically controlled rather than by mechanical motion for the intensity modulation. So we are working on technologies that will make conformal flash radiotherapy accessible. That's an ongoing effort.
Wow, cool.
All right, thank you.
And thanks earlier for the shout out to the Stanford work on EBV biomarkers that was done by Quinn Lee. You said she was part of my group, but in fact she's my boss. We do collaborate together on many things, but I work for her.
Yes, point well taken.
Great work. So this was a quick pediatric question, I think. Are Tumor Treating Fields being investigated for pediatric tumors? And the answer is yes, but I don't know exactly where, but I know I've been approached by someone to see if we wanted to participate in that. I don't know the preliminary data yet, but I do know also pediatric patients can get treated with it even off study. So there's still more head and neck questions. And this one's insurance related. Are there difficulties getting IMRT approved by insurance companies for the carotid sparing technique for early stage glottic cancer? And if so, how do we overcome them?
I haven't really yet. Normally when people get when we submit for IMRT for glottic larynx cancers, I have not seen any resistance. If there is resistance, then what you can do is we usually scare, although I have not done this because I haven't encountered it, but we schedule a peer-to-peer, show some of the data that's been shown that it's feasible. And there's no randomized data about, you know, what exact dose is the best to spare the carotid, although that's forthcoming. There's gonna be a Canadian trial that's going to be looking at partial sparing with IMRT versus standard opposed laterals with 3D technique. So that data is not out there yet, but we use some data for lymphoma doses, and typically we try to restrict the carotid dose to 20, 30 gray. So there is data out there that you can achieve that with IMRT sparing the treatment of the glottic, early stage glottic larynx cancers. But you would have to schedule a peer-to-peer, I think, and also justify that in the setting of the patient's clinical context.
All right, wonderful, thank you. So there's one last pediatric question before we have a couple more head and neck. I'm not sure if we're gonna run out of time. We're already maybe a minute over, but this one pertains to, do you recommend proton radiotherapy for craniospinal irradiation rather than x-rays? And what do you do if a center doesn't have access to protons? So I think this is a very patient-specific question and whether or not they have the means to travel to a proton center to get them. But I do think there's a benefit. I think the benefit diminishes with greater hardship for the family. I think in the girls where the ovaries and the uterus are internal, there might be more of a benefit there for sparing of those structures with protons. I do have a, I get to work at a proton center, so I tend to think that it is a very good technology. It, for the CSI part of it, does not spare better neurocognition. It's the boost part that spares better neurocognition. So it's really all the anterior structures in the spine. But I have to say, VMAT technology is fantastic for craniospinal and really diminishes the dose, especially if you're just treating thecal sac alone. So I think protons are great because it does diminish the integral dose, but if a patient can't travel, it's okay. We have other means that we can treat the patient really well with. So let's go back to Dr. Hugh for another question. There's actually two related questions. Are you using simultaneous integrated boost with IMRT and definitive head and neck cancer with chemotherapy? And if so, when? And then there's a question about altered fractionation and early stage non-chemotherapy oropharynx cancer.
So I do use integrated boost for nearly every single patient getting concurrent chemo radiation. I find it to be a lot more easy on my planners, and I just like the way that it's a much more, you can definitely control the dose better versus these sequential plans, because there's a lot of changes that are going on with the tumor and the patient's anatomy. So I like to just have it all done, all the treatments done, the same plan done throughout the whole course of treatment. With regard to altered fractionated radiation in those, what was the question exactly? What, for patients getting radiation only?
Radiation only in early stage oropharyngeal cancer.
Yeah,
early stage oropharyngeal cancer, radiation alone. Do you use altered fractionation?
Yes, you can extrapolate sort of, you see from the data from just early stage glottic larynx cancers that there seems to be a sweet spot for treatment duration. And so there, for oropharynx cancers that don't need chemotherapy, I utilize this RTOG's trial where they've delivered 66 gray in 30 fractions as often as I can, apply, so that it minimizes the treatment schedule for the patient. So logistically, it's more feasible, but also the toxicity is actually been demonstrated as being well tolerated in an RTOG trial. But the use of classic altered fractionated radiation, where we give BID dosing or hyperfractionated dosing, that is something that I tend not to do in this day and age with IMRT. It's just very difficult. If I do select an altered fractionated radiation approach, I tend to use the Tahanka regimen of doing 6 treatments per week, where I do a BID treatment on one day. But if you look at the data, for early stage oropharynx cancers, there's really no benefit of altered fractionated radiation. It's really for the stage 3 and 4 patients where all the altered fractionated data benefit has been shown to occur. So for someone with early stage oropharynx cancer, I use a accelerated treatment, a more hypofractionated treatment, just because I know that it's been done in a multi-institutional setting and it's shown to be safe. So it's really more for logistical reasons rather than a local region control benefit.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we still have 2 more questions, but I know we're out of time, but maybe we can sort of answer them succinctly. One is a follow-up to a previous discussion. Do you recommend vascular carotid monitoring post-head and neck radiation?
So Dave Brazell actually he's passionate about doing vascular monitoring. I don't think that it's commonly practiced, but he will, so I forgot what exactly his recommendations were for ultrasound. I tend to do this for patients who I think are going to be at risk for developing atherosclerosis from radiation. So people with risk factors for atherosclerosis are those who I'm most worried about, or if I see that there's a lot of toxicity long-term in terms of fibrosis in the neck, that's where I will consider doing a vascular, a Doppler ultrasound. but the right timing and the right follow-up of that is still not established. So it's really been based on just clinical a sense of who might need it and where the yield might be high.
Yeah. Just to interject what we're doing in the pediatric world, if a patient has had neck radiation, like a parameningeal rhabdo, and they're 10, 20, 30 years out, we are trying to get neck imaging and in some cases MRAs for the brain imaging as well, if it goes intracranial. Mm-hmm. So you have one last question, Dr. Hugh. This is a patient, it's basically a case that someone wants to present to you. It's very interesting though. So the patient had a stage one glottic, well-differentiated squamous cell carcinoma, completed hypofractionated radiotherapy. Post-treatment PET CT was negative. However, at 10 weeks, an endoscopy and laryngeal biopsy remained positive for squamous cell carcinoma. How would you manage this? Would you observe it or would you refer for laryngectomy? The patient is asymptomatic.
And that's a good question, because typically we, you know, for patients who we consider, organ preservation treatment for, we usually wait 12 weeks, right, for a PET CT before we get a false negative or positive. And you know, if for someone who's at 12 weeks, you know, I don't know if there's a magic number, but if there's, I think that if it's biopsy proven at 12 weeks, then you're really, really stretching it to try to observe, because that typically we wait 6 weeks. In the past, we used to wait 6 to 8 weeks after definitive treatment to see if there was a need for surgery. So at 12 weeks, I would be very concerned about waiting. But if it's a small tumor and the surgeon and the radiation oncologist think it could be a false positive, then perhaps waiting for a little longer to let it declare itself, it makes sense, especially if it's early stage. Most of these early stage glottic larynx cancers, they're not at significant risk for spreading to the lymph nodes. So having disease spread outside the larynx is probably going to be pretty low. So I think probably watching, I don't know. What do you guys think? That's a challenging question. I haven't seen that.
The cost is the loss of a larynx. So I think it's reasonable to observe for a little bit, but this is clearly not my area. This is a tough one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Billy, what about you? You did some
head and neck. Yeah. I think the larynx is actually at least reasonably easy to watch.
Yeah.
I would tend to favor actually seeing some change in size. I mean, I guess it brings up the question, what prompted the biopsy, right? I mean, if the tumor, it's so uncommon for these tumors not to respond, you know. I mean, so if it's like on its way down, right. I would take the biopsy with a little bit of a grain of salt. I mean, if it didn't respond at all, or certainly if it's showing signs of getting bigger over time, then it's another story.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. We do all have our experience with these, but that would be very unusual. So I agree. I think the reason why they had the biopsy, there must have been something that prompted that. I mean, because usually these, you see them 4 weeks out and their tumor is completely gone. So.
All right. I'm getting a message from the Astro team that I should be wrapping things up.
Okay.
But thank you everyone for joining us, and thank you for joining us remotely. And I hope everyone stays safe through this terrible crisis, but it's good to see everyone, or at least the three of you, or the three of us looking good. But all right. Take care. Thanks everyone.
Sorry for moderating. Great job.
Thanks. Great talks. Take care.
Take care.